A very good morning. This is On the Record. David Davenport sitting in for Gavin Riley with you until 1 o'clock today. If you want to contact the programme, you can text us on 53106 at a cost of 30 cent. We're also on Twitter at Newstalk FM and myself at the DDP. A busy show on the way over the next 2 hours. We'll start by taking a look at the Sunday papers. Our panel in studio this morning, Alan Dukes, former leader of Fine Gael, Pat Rabbit, former leader of the Labour Party, currently chair of TUSLA and proud Mayo man after last night, I should say, and Pauline Maranin Quinn, barrister and mediator who served as the first insurance ombudsman of Ireland and also for the Defence Forces. Good morning to you. Thanks for joining us. No bank holiday, I'm afraid, for Brexit preparations and speculation this morning. In the Sunday Times, Stephen O'Brien suggests that the bones of a trade-off may be becoming visible, with Leo Varadkar pushing for an all-island customs regime for food and agriculture. That would mean no border checks, with checks instead on ports. That comes as Geoffrey Donaldson revealed that the DUP would be comfortable with a time limit on the border backstop, something our government, of course, would not countenance at the moment. In the Business Post, there's a profile of Dominic Cummings, the political sorcerer and architect of the successful Vote Leave campaign, who's now ensconced in Downing Street, with a mission, we're told, to put an end to a Britain which kowtows to a European behemoth, which Cummings believes is bankrupt of ideas and rotten to the core. The Mail on Sunday has Bruce Arnold defending his piece in the Daily Telegraph, which was harshly critical of Leo Varadkar and which drew the ire of Simon Coveney on Twitter. And in the Sunday Times, David Quinn laments the hypersensitivity here over Brexit, pointing out that inflammatory arguments on the Remain side pass unnoticed, while anyone who challenges the Brexit orthodoxy gets it in the neck. And that's a theme picked up by one of the Brexit awkward squad, the Indo's Owen Harris, asking how the Irish media will justify what he calls their monstrous mendacity when the backstop chickens come home to roost and we're stuck with a hard border. His paper leads with an opinion poll that not surprisingly shows we're all a bit worried about the economic future with Brexit on the horizon, but we are, it seems, stoical about the challenges and generally feel comfortable about how we're dealing with them. Elsewhere, the broadcast charge is attracting attention, with the Sunday Times telling us in an editorial that it shouldn't take 5 years to devise a replacement for the TV licence fee, urging a simple household charge or just adding the bill to utility or TV service bills. The Business Post warns RTE that it must spend its money wisely and be prepared to act transparently if it's to have its funding enhanced. And in the same paper, news that On Post is alarmed at the prospect of losing the job of collecting the fee. And there's a clear signal that revenue aren't interested in the job, with the spokesman for the taxman pointedly insisting their statutory responsibility is the fair and efficient administration of tax and customs legislation. The Sunday World has Leo Varadkar, the star of the show at the Belfast Pride Parade, the North's biggest parade, he said, wasn't orange or green, but rainbow-coloured. Well, I suppose, Pat Rabbit, the parade in Castlebar last night was definitely red and green. You must be a happy man. Great spirit there, particularly in the last quarter.
Fantastic, David. Fantastic. Another roller coaster. This is a very special team. This is their eighth appearance in a semi-final in 9 years. A remarkable record. I mean, the Dubs are bidding fair to be the best team in the history of Gaelic football. Now, Kerry will have something to say about that, but Mayo is certainly the best. This Mayo team is the best team that has never won in All-Ireland. The rate of attrition of injuries this year that they have surmounted is extraordinary. Donegal put in a splendid performance against Kerry and were favourites last night. But every time this particular Mayo team has their back against the wall, they come through. And last night was the ferocity and intensity of the tackling and the turnovers, especially in the first half, the likes of which I don't think I've ever seen before. They're an exceptional group of fellows. I'd love to see them win in All-Ireland. They haven't. But by God, they are special.
It was a great display, all right. Sticking with the Jersey agenda, though, looking at Brexit, a lot of the papers seem to be critical of what they see as an emergent groupthink that we're all pulling on the green jersey and we're perhaps blind to the downside of the stance that the government is taking. To come to you first, Pat, on that, what do you think?
Well, maybe they're right in the sense that there is a great unity around the position set out by government, the Taoiseach and Minister for Foreign Affairs, Simon Coveney. But insofar as I can follow those who question the backstop, for example, they're not advancing an alternative. I mean, it's easy to criticise the position of government, but where is the alternative? I agree, the situation that we're heading for would seem to be extremely serious. If the Sunday Business Post piece on Dominic Cummings, I must say, worries me more than the new Prime Minister bumbling around what he calls the four nations of the UK. Because this Dominic Cummings fellow, anybody, for example, who has read the two books by Tim Shipman on the conduct of the referendum, this is a Svengali-like figure who is so zealous about the project that I can't imagine any Prime Minister appointing him unless he intends to crash out. And that's almost beyond belief. I mean, given the impact on his own country, on business, on jobs, but he's taking us down with him in the sense that arguably Northern Ireland will suffer more than anybody else. So, yeah, it's easy to criticise groupthink, but you normally have to put forward an alternative. I don't see the alternative.
Pauline Marilyn Quinn, you've been involved in a good deal of mediation. Positions have hardened since Boris Johnson entered Downing Street. He's saying, of course, that he won't talk to Europe until they concede the backstop, whereas, of course, Europe says the backstop is sacrosanct. Now, these are two pretty entrenched positions. What's the first step in getting people down off those positions?
It's difficult to get them down. One can certainly objectively see why it was allowed to get here. And I think we have to take a large part of the blame there in that there was a failure on our part to communicate our position. I think there's an increasing... and I actually depressed myself last night by looking up the cabinet of Boris Johnson and the things that they have said. There's a record of things that they've said in the last while about Ireland and about the not just in the context of Brexit. You have Boris Johnson's own father saying, ah, if Margaret Thatcher were around, she'd solve this problem. She would just say, and he gives a hypothetical quote, oh, the Irish, whether they have a border or not, they'd be shooting each other anyway. So we've reached really the pits. And in terms of conflict resolution, Margaret Thatcher and Theresa May were not dissimilar in the sense of their approach to trying to manage the whole Brexit affair from the start. They made their decisions clear from the outset and they talked about red lines. I mean, Theresa May's Lancaster House speech was a disaster from a conflict resolution point of view or any kind of a diplomatic approach to having an agreed settlement or outcome. So she was on a hiding to nothing. And what we have done is, unfortunately, we've allowed this to prevail and things to get worse and worse and worse. And I think we should be looking at the backgrounds of some of the people in that cabinet in the United Kingdom. And again, I agree with Pat, this Dominic Cummings man is frightening. But nevertheless, there is a position there that the British just want to keep confirming about us. But what have we done on our side of it? And I'm afraid, I'm sure he's not really worried this morning or I'm not ruining his coffee. But I'm very annoyed with Brendan O'Connor's piece in the front of the Independent, self-deprecatory, talking about us a day after the crash out. We'll be all walking around drunk, looking for food at Tato Park. Unforgivable stuff. But only to me, because last night I kind of reminded myself of how critical the situation is. And also the fact that we have failed. I think we now have just about time, although Owen Harris said that Leo Varadkar doesn't have time even to eat humble pie. We need to reverse this. We need to start in any conflict resolutions environment. We need to start positioning ourselves with an onslaught, putting the other side on notice of our questions. We never ask questions. And Channel 4 has a wonderful service at the moment doing fact check. Mm. They looked at this man, Dominic Raab, who I also think is a highly dangerous chap. And he said that he had discussed the dangers of a crash out Brexit. Channel 4's fact check, and I think all our journalists should be doing this now and exposing people, have checked, and he didn't actually do that. Mm. Why did we never actually ask in any of our exchanges what discussions had taken place about the Northern Irish commitments for the British government in the event of the Brexit referendum. Did they ever? I have tried to do a fact check on that and I found nothing. So what we need now in the time that's left, I believe fervently, we need to start asking questions of them. It shouldn't be, I mean, I'm angry because of what they're saying about us, but we need to control the anger. We need to go back and ask questions. Well, what if? And how would you propose to do this? And what will happen about that? And what about your commitments under the Good Friday Agreement? And let them answer. And let them be put in a position where they are exposed as having gone into this blindfolded.
I'm not sure how successful you'd be in getting answers from Boris Johnson and his cohorts. But do you think, Alan Jukes, that the time has passed for railing against the shortcomings of Boris Johnson and his cabinet and the ridiculous things that have been said? They're the government we have to deal with now. They're in the driving seat. If you ask me, if there were to be a general election, Boris looks like a winner compared to Jeremy Corbyn. So should we not just calm down and say, look, let's deal with these people?
Yeah, I think if it's true that Cummings is going to have the kind of influence that he is expected to have, I could see a general election campaign in the UK being conducted by the Tories in a way that's designed to get the Brexit Party voters back into the Tories as, you know, being the only people who can produce a government. But there's another issue here. I think Pauline's right to talk about, you know, the questions that need to be looked at. And I have to say this, and I'm not being sour about this, I think politicians on both sides of the Irish Sea have failed to learn the lesson. I think politicians regularly do it, and commentators also, that they need to be very careful about the kind of language they use at the beginning of a problem.
Right.
The constant tendency is to use kind of over-the-top language at the beginning, and you're forced into getting more and more over-the-top as you go along, and that's what's happened in this whole Brexit thing, on both sides. Mind you, I think the rhetoric has been less cranked up on this side than on the UK side, but that's a matter of judgment. But the point I'm coming to is that it seems to me that the very fact that on both sides of this argument, people have said we cannot have any border between the Republic and Northern Ireland. Our government has said it, the European Union has said it, and the UK government, Theresa May and Boris Johnson, have said it. And the British even go to the point of saying that if there is a border between the two, it will be the Irish and the EU who put it there. Now, the logic of the situation is, if the UK leaves the customs union and the single market, there will have to be a border. And if they don't have one the day after, the British are going to have to put one up the following day. Now, question, do we really need that? If the UK leaves the single market and the customs union, the one inevitable result will be some arrangement about tariffs. But if you look at what the single market is, I have a question there. Currently, the UK has the same legislation about standards, food quality, rules of origin as the European Union. And they actually passed an act to formally establish that in British legislation, so that even if they crash out, they will have the same set of standards that the European Union has. Nobody has asked, as far as I can see, nobody has asked the British government why they would want to depart from any of these. They serve British interests extremely well because they make it possible to trade not only with the rest of the European Union, but EU standards are accepted in a lot of cases,
but
much more widely around the world. Let me make the point, Pat. If the UK government, after crash out Brexit or any kind of Brexit, gets to the point where there is a sector where they feel it would be to their advantage to change the rules, then I think there's a legitimate discussion between the European Union and the UK for that sector. And that would be much less complicated than all the rows we're going to have about where we do the border checks. Do them only where it's required. There will be checks required for the administration of tariffs. There's no doubt about that. But for the rest, I think, you know, in the immediate future, and indeed, I would think even in the long term, the UK will find it entirely to its advantage to stick with the same kind of standards and regulations that the European Union has.
Of course, the UK was instrumental in bringing about the single market.
But some of the wild men in the Rees-Mogg ERG group have committed themselves to repealing that legislation. And, you know, given what we have seen, they're capable of going down that road. I don't know how many of you saw the statement last week by Marc Francois, the Tory backbencher, to the effect that there are 60-odd members of his group who are likely to be displeased even if the backstop were abandoned, that they have other grievances with the withdrawal agreement. I mean, the interesting thing here, which, of course, the British don't acknowledge, is that the original Irish proposition in respect of a backstop for Northern Ireland only is a very interesting one, which puts Northern Ireland in the best of both worlds.
But that's not acceptable to the DUP.
It's not acceptable to the DUP, but if I were the DUP, I'd be very, very cautious about commitments from Boris Johnson. I mean, Geoffrey Donaldson, the moderate wing of the DUP, is not right when he talks about they being asked to abandon the market into which they sell 70% of their goods, meaning Britain. Nobody is stopping him exporting into Britain. The problem is if there was non-compliance in imports, there would be an issue. Yeah. But there's no issue in terms of, he would have the best of both worlds in terms of accessing the single market and accessing the European market. And it was the British who broadened that out to include the entire, I don't know whether it's possible to come back to that, because I think, given the parliamentary arithmetic, no matter what Dominic Cummings and Boris Johnson do, they may find it not quite so easy to crash out, if that's their determination.
Mm. But there's a point here
I think that, you know, taking on from what Pat is saying there and going, just trying to get a thread to this conversation about the need for the right language, the right talking, the right structure now. We need not to have been on the offensive. We are in a position where our next door neighbour has decided to do something. We should have taken a much more paced approach to this and asked the critical questions, reminding them every so often of what I remember Peter Sutherland, God rest his soul, unfortunately we don't have him now, on Newsnight, that programme on BBC Two around the time of the referendum. Peter coming on and being able to lay the thing out so clearly, ask the questions, talk about GATT. He'd been, of course, the head of GATT, but was able to say, no, that's not possible. How would you do that? How would you do this? We have stopped doing that, and there isn't anybody, there's no voice out there doing it. We have a border in Ireland. This is the irony. There is a border, and we've lived in this wonderful kind of halcyon time without ignoring it, as it were.
Are you saying as well it's time to stop being beastly to the Brits, as it were?
I obviously, as a conflict resolution practitioner, wouldn't be advocating being beastly to anybody. But what I am saying is that we need to, and I would think the worst thing we can do now is show division in our own ranks. We don't want backbenchers coming out. We don't want front page commentaries talking about our bad approach. We need now to gather ourselves together and start getting the vocabulary, the dialogue correct. Start asking the questions. Start posing the realities to them. These are an entrenched, and I think that these Rees-Mogg people, we can laugh at them. And I would also, my own plea this morning is to everybody to stop laughing at Boris Johnson, stop laughing at Rees-Mogg. These people are not funny. These people are menaces. Michael Gove is on record as saying that he didn't agree with the Belfast Agreement.
That's and right. lamenting
the withdrawal of humiliation of the British military having to leave. Yeah. These are dangerous people. But sorry, Anne.
Alan Jeeves, do you see any future in the suggestion as proposed for an all-Ireland unit for agriculture and food? Do you think that's a runner?
That's what we have at the moment. We have a single animal health and food regulation structure. And I think if it can be done, that needs to be kept. But I think there are two issues, again, that we need to look at. If you talk about the DUP, Arlene Foster and Geoffrey Donaldson and various other spokespeople of the DUP have said repeatedly that they want to see what they call a sensible Brexit. Nobody has asked them to define what a sensible Brexit is.
Let's hear what they have in mind.
I think that's fair. Mm. And Pauline's other questions are extremely relevant. The problem is that even posing those questions was made much more difficult by the fact that in her Lancaster house, Theresa May outlined red lines. I think the real problems lie in those red lines. There's no evidence to show that David Davis or any of his successors as the Brexit Secretary brought any discussion of those red lines into the talks with Michel Barnier. And I think had that been done, it would have been much easier to work out a solution to this. But when you get faced with red lines, then there isn't much point.
The Brexit Secretary.
We'll return to all this in a couple of moments. You're listening to News Talks on the Record. David Davenport in for Gavin Riley this morning. Back with more from our panel in just a moment. This is David Davenport in for Gavin Riley. Today on the Record, still joined by my panel, Alan Dukes, Pat Rabbit and Pauline Marinan-Quinn. Just to wrap up our discussion about Brexit, there seems to be consensus around the table that sooner rather than later there's going to be an election in the UK. How do you see the cards falling after that, Pauline?
What do you think about this? I'd be very interested. There are two leading politicians beside me, but the possible alignment, the recent by-election in the UK where the Greens stood back to let the Liberal Democrats get in. Do you think there's any potential there for any kind of mass movement to keep both Boris Johnson's government and Brexit out? The Brexit Party out?
I think the most significant factor is the complete chaos and dysfunction in the Labour Party. You can only have an alternative government, notwithstanding recent changes in Britain, provided by the Labour Party. And in my view, that's not going to happen. And it gives some element of logic to Boris Johnson's conduct. Because as Alan said earlier, he will fight an election on the basis of winning back as much of that Brexit Party vote as he can get. And quite frankly, if the default position is crash out, and he crashes out and causes an election immediately after that, I'm sorry to say that, in my view, I think he will win it.
And I think you know, that kind of very hardline approach, with the prospect of actually forming a government, will get back Brexit Party votes to the Tories. Because in their wildest imaginings, I don't think the Brexit Party could ever believe that they'd win enough seats to form a government. Pauline's question about the kind of deal that was done in the Welsh by-election, I think that's probably possible in the circumstances of a by-election. Yeah. But it would be extremely difficult to get agreement on that in a general election. And as Pat says, with the absolutely fractured nature of the Labour Party in the UK at the moment, I can't see that you could even have a sensible conversation with the Labour Party.
Nobody's pointing out, though, apart from Michael McDool in the Sunday Business Post today, that the Tories put up a candidate who had been disgraced for fiddling his expenses. He was their candidate. So there was, they were behind the eight ball from day one. There was never any chance they were going to keep that seat.
Well, not only had he been disgraced, it was a recall vote. People said, we don't want this fella.
Yeah.
And they put him up again.
But there you are. That's I suppose, another illustration
what
of the state
Corbyn,
of dysfunction.
I mean, what is the position? Do you think there's a possibility of a leadership challenge in the Labour Party in the UK?
They made a mess of it the last time. Yeah. I mean, he has around him the kind of people that have killed off any prospect of an alternative government. I mean, Corbyn has always been more interested in leading a protest movement than he has in becoming prime minister. And the sensible people like Starmer and Hilary Benn and those who tried to articulate a reasonable position are completely, overruled by the we used to call them the militant in the days of
Joe Higgins,
Neil Kinnock.
Yeah, but they're not just militants; they're authoritarian.
They are.
There is an iron rule at the centre of the Labour Party around Corbyn, which is completely out of touch with the ordinary, decent members of the Labour Party.
Anyway, let's move on to the more tranquil waters of Irish politics and the broadcasting charge in particular. Pat, what's your perspective on this? You're the minister. You didn't get it over the line. What magic potion had Richard Bruton got?
Yeah, well, Richard Bruton doesn't seem to want to get it over the line. I wanted to, but I was derailed by the water charges protests. It all depends on your attitude to public service broadcasting. And I would have thought that the discussion that we have just had about Brexit highlights why you need a public service broadcaster in this country. I'm not saying that content, public service content, is confined to the public service broadcaster. It manifestly is not. But there is an obligation on the public service broadcaster to do the kind of programmes that Pauline has talked about in the context of our discussion about Brexit. And this was ready to go in 2014.
Right.
That's 5 years ago. And for some reason, Richard, I'm amazed that Richard Bruton has lent his name to this stunt. It's going to take him 5 years to divine what kind of alternative devices are coming down the tracks at us. I'm not at all sure why he's going to be more sure of them in 5 years than he is today.
The problem is that they're there already.
They're there already.
But we don't know what's coming down the
tracks.
That's
the reason why you have to broaden the charge, because people are watching public service content now on platforms other than the traditional TV in the room.
But do you have a view on how the devices can be defined, or is it simply going to be a household charge that everybody's going to have to pay irrespective?
Well, that's the simplest. And what, for some reason, the government is not telling, but I don't think they're serious about it, is that if you're paying your TV licence, you have no fear of the broadcasting charge. I intended to bring it in at €5 less than the 160 for the TV licence. So the only people who need be concerned about the universal charge are the people who are evading it. And no week ever passed, David, while I was minister, that I didn't get two or three letters, or if there was a row, 100 emails about the television licence. I never, to this day, got a single letter about the punters who are prepared to pay €200, €300 for Sky Sports. That was never an issue.
Yeah.
But the TV licence, for some reason. Now, if you think that we're an independent little country, that we have our own take on matters, political, cultural, social, and so on, if you think the quality of our public discourse matters, if you think how we impact on the character of politics matters, then we need investment in public service. I was
at a broadcasting conference in the Balkans there a couple of months ago, and when you see the state of public service broadcasting in those countries, it really does bring it home.
Pauline. I did a lot of work there when I was the Ombudsman for the Defence Forces, so there's a lot to be seen in terms of democracy. And public service broadcasting's arm in that and role in that. I was just going to say there, listening to Pat, we can't have a broadcast household, but lots and lots of people don't have households. We're talking about a society at the moment where household really doesn't exist, and the very thought of that is just phantasmagoria. In terms of the TV licence, all that Pat said prevails. We do need one. We need to have public sector broadcasting properly funded. I do think that there is an argument for having it done on a monthly basis. And I also controversially will say, I don't think that a 12% failure rate is a big rate.
Alan?
Yeah, I'm not as close to this as Pat is, but I'm impressed by what he says about people paying for streaming services and about the fact that people who pay their television licence would have nothing to fear from this broadcasting charge. People pay for streaming. And I think there are a lot of the apps that people use for this for which you actually have to pay. Is there not a way of getting some of that revenue stream or some increase in that revenue stream for the public service?
Well, that's one of the suggestions, isn't it?
Instead of going after individuals, you'd go after the companies to find a way of getting a contribution from them. I agree entirely with what Pat has said and Pauline about the value of public service broadcasting. I think that's essential, and we must find ways of making sure it's there. I mean, I fought before pastime battles in cabinet to make sure that we got a licensing system for independent radio and broadcasting around the country.
And in opposition, if I remember correctly, you stood up against Ray Burke when he wanted to take to himself the power to grant licenses.
Yeah, I mean, public service broadcasting, to my mind, is an essential part of any civilization, and we must keep it.
But Pat, I sometimes think that RTE doesn't make the best case for itself, bar rattling the begging bowl. I mean, you see another organisation that's facing great challenges, Bord na Mona, and they have a detailed plan, a roadmap, including, we learned today, a proposal to grow cannabis in the bogs. Interesting. But RTE doesn't ever seem to lay out that kind of template for ministers. What was your experience?
Yeah, I think that's a fair criticism. I mean, selling off land is not a strategic plan for the future. I mean, you can only sell it off once. And, you know, there is that peculiar relationship, always has been, between whatever the government of the day is and RTE, since RTE was founded. And that's good that it should be the case. There's a board in RTE. They are charged with the strategic future of the organisation at a time when advertising is migrating to the big digital companies in frightening proportions. And there is an irreducible minimum. I mean, if you compare it to the BBC's, which we are fortunate to receive, if you were to compare the BBC's to American television and so on, but they have a huge base. And the amount of revenue that the BBC has compared to RTE is minuscule. And if you fall below a certain level, I mean, you were talking about Mayo's victory last night. Look at how well RTE does sport, for example.
It's a dwindling menu, though, isn't it?
Well, is it? Is it? I mean, I think...
Well, it's losing out chunks of it.
I was watching the Mayo match on Sky.
Oh, you mean in terms of others eroding it? Yeah. Yes. And, you know, why that kind of thing happens and so on, you know, is a debate we should have. Sorry, I thought you meant that sport was becoming less attractive in this country than it's getting more so. We're now into cricket.
Yes, and doing very well.
Yes,
and rowing.
Yeah.
Yeah, indeed.
Is the cross gone from Mayo this year?
I wasn't going to mention that. Ladies and gentlemen, take a break now. You're listening to News Talks on the Record. David Davenport in for Gavin Riley this morning. We'll be back with more from our panel in a moment. This is David Davenport in for Gavin today. My panel, Pauline Marinan Quinn, Alan Dukes and Pat Rabbit. Pat, as well as being a former minister, you're obviously currently the chair of TUSLA, which has been in the news over the last couple of weeks over the controversy surrounding the hide-and-seek creche. Now, there's a suggestion in today's Sunday Times in a piece by Stephen O'Brien that TUSLA is a bit cross with RTE for sitting on the information that it had at its disposal about bad behaviour in these creches. Is that the case?
Well, there is an obligation to report. This was underway for some 2.5 months, I'm advised, before RTE brought it to the attention of TUSLA. But, you know, a journalist, I would imagine, would argue if it were ever contested that she or he were engaged in making a programme that would override the balance of advantage in that situation. I think it's interesting that there is so minimal coverage today, and I think that is because the point has got through that this was an outlier. This particular case in hide and seek is not typical of the service providers throughout the country. There are 4,500 such service providers throughout the country, and nowadays, the early years inspectorate is very rigorous. But of course, if you sent an army of inspectors into a particular creche, given some of the things that we saw in the RTE programme, like adult abuse of children, that wouldn't go on if the inspector or an army of inspectors went in every day. You know, that did take the kind of secret filming that took place.
But do you feel that RTE could have given you a heads up earlier?
I'm torn on that issue between, you're right, some senior managers are very agitated about this because they take very seriously the imperative to report any risk to any child, and they don't make exceptions for that. I acknowledge the journalistic, the professional journalistic requirement to put together a programme and perhaps take some time to establish whether it is the case that there are practices
that are unacceptable.
Of course, people are arguing that Tuzla isn't completely transparent itself in that you have 37 creches where serious shortcomings have been identified, but you're not in a position to tell the parents where these creches are.
Well, I take the opposite view on that. It would undermine enforcement if you were to do that. The service providers concerned have a right to fair procedure. And when there are 37 service providers on the critical list, that means that they are in danger of the next step, which is deregistration.
But do the parents not have a right to know that their children are in one of these
classes? Well, as the law stands, I mean, the minister has written to me last week about that and asked for proposals in respect of finessing the law. But as the law stands, one can't do that. And also, I think it's important to explain, I mean, out of 4,500, if the chief executive of Tuzla came to me and said, we have three on the critical list, I'd say I would be sceptical. 37 doesn't surprise me, because remember what...
No, I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue is whether parents should be told or not.
Well, we would have to finesse the law. We'd have to refurbish the law.
And would you like to see that law change?
But I think you would undermine... you see, the purpose of enforcement mainly here is to oblige the service provider to bring the standard up to scratch, which most of them do.
So it's a balance between effective enforcement and transparency.
That's right.
I think two months was too long for the production team to take. I think they ought to have brought it to Tuzla's attention earlier. And notwithstanding their editorial priority over their programming, I think that was just too long of a gap.
Well, I think, on the other hand, I mean, I think there's a lot in the point that we should require, or we should allow investigative journalists enough time to make sure of their ground.
That's true.
Before they make a...
Two months is rather a long time.
And I suppose they could argue that if they had told Tuzla earlier on, Tuzla would have been obliged to notify the people who were under investigation, and that would have taken away some of the impact.
It's worth saying that putting together a program like that is a time-consuming and complicated business,
yes,
both legally and practically. So in RTE's defence, I can see a rationale for perhaps not being in a position to give Tuzla the heads up.
The difficulty is to strike the balance between, if you like, what investigative journalists think is their obligation to present stories and the service providers' concern in being notified of
an
investigation.
And their objective in having the investigation.
That's another balance to be struck, indeed.
But also the objective, because if they had done that, it would have vindicated the research and the programme by providing Tuzla with an opportunity of going in with an inspector, perhaps.
Well, that's the difference between these
reports, David, are put up on the website. But while the investigation is going on, the parents are not advised under the present arrangement. And that is, you know, because the service providers have rights in this situation. And as I say, the experience is that the investigation is de-escalated because, you know, they may have too few childcare workers when inspected, or the premises may be too small, or whatever. And most of the providers set about trying to bring that up to scratch. And when you get an outlier in circumstances here, which was pretty shocking and entirely unacceptable, and where there was apparently evidence of elder abuse, of adult abuse of children, when that's a very serious...
We could move on. We could talk about Tuzla and the creches indefinitely, and it's a topic, I think, with childcare being such a big issue, that's going to come up again and again. But let's move on. You noticed, as a former insurance ombudsman, Pauline Marnin, a plaintiff appeal from the boss of FBD, demonising the insurers won't bring costs down.
Yes. Fiona Muldoon, who's the chief executive of FBD insurance company, who's done very well for the company in the last, during the beginning and since her tenure started. Very interesting to have a woman heading up an insurance company like that, and they've made substantial profits, which she claims is due to the very wise investments that she's made on behalf of the company, and this may be true. But nevertheless, Junior Minister Darcy has come out saying that he didn't hold insurance companies in very high regard. And he's talking about the fact that they've made a profit. And he's somehow kind of creating a link between that, hypothetically, and the fact that we've got such very high premiums. Now, it's a contentious issue. And of course, they're always bashing around, looking for ways of blaming someone. And usually the legal profession is at the end of that, the brunt of that criticism.
Or fraudsters.
But I mean,
never the insurance companies.
Funnily enough, during my tenure as insurance ombudsman, which was in the early 90s, and Pat was in the Department of the
Commerce.
In that period, I found that there was only one in a period of 6 years of somebody who was putting on an act about a claim in the cases that came to me. But also what I would say is that the blame then was, in those days, was the legal profession having two seniors and get away with the two senior rule, and the legal profession were putting the costs up. I used to be privy to the files, and I remember looking at the smallest claims that were being investigated by the insurance industry, and you would not believe the costs that were accrued in those files by people who were going around as private investigators, claims assessors, claims adjusters.
Engineers.
We're talking about huge fees, and my eyes were open to this. Wasn't the legal profession they were putting up
but
the cost of these
insurance
claims.
Companies didn't do themselves any favours. I don't know if you saw that sequence at the Oil Committee a couple of weeks ago where Pierce Doherty really called them out over the scale of fraud and whether it was impacting on their bottom line. And they were not able to come up with figures to justify
it. I would doubt that very much so. I mean, I remember one poor gentleman who had a truck with him about a life policy, and he was in his 80s, and I had privy to this file, and I remember it went back and forth, and he had brought very, very important point to the surface about life policies and linked to the investment side. And the file went back and forth between the loss adjuster and the various people in the company, highly, highly regarded company. And at the end, the two adjusters were writing to each other, and one was back and forwards throughout the office over a period of about 3 years. He has a point, and the other man repeated back, wrote on the file and said, "Don't worry, he's 84. Hold on to it. He made eye." So, I mean, you know, I think Minister Darcy saying he doesn't hold them in too high regard has probably got a bit of a point.
Well, I think, to be fair, Fiona Muldoon also mentioned the fact that one of the influences on the level of FPD's profitability in the last year was the fact that we had a relatively calm year last year climatically. We didn't have, you know, huge floods and so on. So there was a chunk of what has become part of the claims picture in the last 2 years that wasn't there. There's also the point that, you know, the insurance companies have a kind of a memory in the not too distant past of having very substantial claims made against them for particularly adverse weather events. You know, so they're wondering, is this going to happen again? And with climate change and so on, that they're looking to a future. But I do think that they have been less than honest in giving an account of where the costs have come.
Oh yes, they won't insure you if you're near a river or if you put in a flood claim.
Pauline, in the couple of minutes that are left to us, Alan Jukes, the new incoming governor of the central bank, Gabriel McLouf, do you share the growing concerns about his appointment, given that the question marks over his handling of this leak inquiry, if it could be called that, in New Zealand, seem to be growing?
Well, I don't know if one can kind of second guess the appointment process that was gone through here, but it seems to me, first of all, he made a very unwise decision. I mean, it emerged that budget information had leaked in New Zealand. He first claimed that the system had been hacked and then was obliged to say afterwards that there had been an inadvertent leak.
Does this cast a shadow over his new role, though? That's the question.
It casts a shadow over his reaction to a difficult event. Second point is, I don't know who else or what other candidates were examined. But he doesn't have a background in banking. Now, he has a background in public service and in the financial area, in the fiscal area. But I'm not sure that that's necessarily relevant to banking. So I don't know. I can't second guess the process that appointed him. I would have thought that an internal candidate would have been a good result there.
Briefly, Pat Rabbitt, I think Brendan Helen has called for the whole appointment to be re-examined. Your view?
Well, we've learned our lessons, or we should have learned our lessons the hard way about the necessity to have somebody in charge of the central bank who has a detailed knowledge of banking and risk management and all the rest. It would seem to put a question over his judgment. I mean, in a straightforward, I mean, there's nothing all that unusual about a leak. Why you would jump to the conclusion that your IT system was hacked, as distinct from being certain before you make any public remark as to why what happened, does put a question mark over his judgment.
It does.
But I'm not competent to comment on what Alan has said about, you know, whether he has the wherewithal to do the job. I mean, one of his jobs was backup to Gordon Brown at a time when Gordon Brown had to deal with the crash in Britain. And I imagine that's an experience that's seared into his memory. But whether, you know, that puts him in a position to manage our central bank.
It's a very regrettable position because he comes in with this kind of cloud and doubt over his judgment, which is bad.
We leave you with the last word, Pauline. We'll have to leave it there. My thanks to my panel, Pauline Marinan Quinn, barrister and mediator, Pat Rabbit, the former leader of the Labour Party, and Alan Jukes, the former leader of Fine Gael. Back with lots more for you in just a moment.